The world of work changes, and changes more rapidly than we may realize. Our grandparents probably never met many people who worked in livery stables, and they certainly never knew people who worked at search engine optimization. So the kinds of work certainly change, but so do other aspects of the work experience. People generally do not work at huge rooms full of desks anymore, yay, but they also generally do not work for the same company for decades, and that's a mixed blessing. Our guest this hour gives us a look at the world of work and our approach to it in her book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Faraisha Dea is the author. She spent years reporting for Newsweek, CNN, and ABC, also hosted NPR's News and Notes until its cancellation a few years ago. Farai pops up on many broadcast outlets commenting on race, politics, and culture, and she's the author or co-author of five previous books, including a novel. Faraisha Dea, an honor to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
I'm so delighted to be with you.
So you, in fact, are a great example. People spending 20, 30 years at ABC News just doesn't happen anymore, does it?
You know, for a few it does, but boy, is that a handful. And what's funny in some ways is that I'm now working part-time for 538.com, which does data journalism, but they're in the ABC offices because they're part of the same corporate family. So I'm back in a building where I used to work 15 years ago, doing a totally different job with a totally different set of skills. And it just shows how weird our life work, situation is at this point. I mean, one of the things I always like to point out is that in addition to things being very volatile, they're often also cyclical. So maybe you get laid off and then 5 years later you end up at a company with some of the same people you used to work with. So it's a very strange time where you have to maintain good relationships with people. You have to have lifelong learning and you have to be flexible.
Ah, sounds like lesson number one, don't burn the bridges behind you.
Oh, yeah.
Right. You do not cast yourself as a career guru. You're quite clear about that. But what did lead to the book?
Well, I was doing reporting for a public radio project where I took a team of people and was reporting on the midterm elections in 2010. And so this was right in the aftermath of the Great Recession. People were really on their knees financially, dealing with having lost their homes in the mortgage crisis and having lost jobs and long-term unemployment. And everything seemed to lead back to jobs. You know, when people talked about their hopes for the future and their fears about the future, it all went back to, am I going to be able to be employed? Does the American dream still exist? You know, and I said, well, gee, that's a great question. Let me take a look. And so I decided to do it through a mix of intense personal storytelling, interviewing dozens of people at length, hundreds of people in passing, doing survey research on thousands of people, and talking to economists. So this book has a real, I think, personal feel through all of the stories I was lucky enough to get from people in different walks of life from different parts of the country. But it also gives a real analysis of where the U.S. economy is. And it's not pretty. You know, the reality is we're at a time where technology and globalization are throwing a lot of long-range jobs into turmoil, so everyone has to be flexible.
Well, I guess the major message is that we're not as needed as warm assets. I actually had a company president refer to us once as we once were. Machines
like,
can do the work.
I don't know if I like that.
Yeah, really. So machines can do some of the work, computers can do some of the work, and then people overseas can do the work more cheaply.
Yeah, that's true. But there's also still, I mean, there's so many reasons why, obviously, there are still jobs in America and there's job creation in America. But what I point out is that you need to know whether you're in a field that's losing jobs or a field that's gaining jobs, and not just right now, but what are the trend lines ahead? So if you're not paying attention, you can be like that frog in the pot of warm water that starts to slowly get too warm. And a lot of people ignore some very obvious signs around them in the workplace because they like where they are. They want to stay where they are. And then maybe they survive one round of layoffs, and then there's another round of layoffs. But they're like, "But I'm going to just stay the course." But you know what? Sometimes you have to see the writing on the wall for what it is. Sometimes there's cyclical downturns, but sometimes you're in an entire industry that is disappearing. You know, think about all the people who worked in the landline phone industry. There's still landline phones, but, you know, many more people are using cell phones as their primary phone, sometimes their only phone. And so if you were working in any facet of the landline telecommunications industry, your whole world was disrupted. And if you didn't realize that you were in a shrinking industry, you know, you probably faced some really tough issues. And there's so many different, I mean, like even in the airline industry, something as simple as how many people are working at the desks to greet people who are checking in. Now you have all these kiosks. You still have some people, but you have far fewer than there used to be. So you just have to pay attention to how technology and other factors are affecting your field and make a decision about what your choices are.
You know, we should point out, too, disruption in the workplace is not just something being experienced now. Your mother has a story that you relate in here. What happened to her?
Yeah, you know, she's a fascinating case where my mom, you know, grew up working class in Baltimore, and her family definitely didn't have a lot of money to send her to school, but she got a scholarship. And after that, she went into the Peace Corps. She was a medical technologist. Later, she was a journalist and, you know, a stay-at-home mom and a teacher. So she went through many phases.
A lot of things that she had to learn how to do, and that's one of the messages for us in the book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. Farai Shadeya is the author and a former NPR host as well. Glad to have her here. We'll come back and talk more with her and take phone calls and emails from you if you would like to join the conversation. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Farai Shadeya and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Farai Shadeya, journalist, author, teacher, you name it. She's done a lot of things and probably figures to do a few more, which is rather the point of her book, The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption, how we make those adjustments that allow us to continue working or at least resume working at some point. Perhaps not in the thing we originally trained for. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You do get into who we are as a country in relation to work. And it was interesting because not long after I read what you wrote in here that in France, for example, you don't ask people what they do for a living because it's rude. I heard the same thing from somebody else a few hours later.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, in many cultures, for different reasons, it's just not considered polite to start out a conversation by asking what people do because it's considered either too personal or too judgmental. In some countries, particularly countries where people are poorer, it's assumed that everyone is doing a job that they don't particularly love just to feed their family, and they don't want to spend a lot of time talking about it. It's like, you know, if you're doing a job that is hard manual labor, you know, it's an honorable thing to do, but it's not necessarily your lifelong dream. And why should you be spending time talking about that instead of talking about your family or talking about, you know, other things that are important to you? But in America, we very quickly cut to the chase. And by asking people what they do, we kind of put people into categories. Like, is this person a good catch romantically, like if we're dating? Or is this person a good contact for us? And America can be a very transactional culture where we look at people based on what they can do for us. And that's not all bad, but it can be pushed to its limit. So I think a lot of times what happens is when people lose jobs and they don't have a good answer for what do you do, people start to feel very ashamed. And we can have a shame-based culture where if you're not in the job position where you want to be, you are made to feel like an outcast. And so I ask us to really reconsider that approach. Not that we never ask people what their jobs are, but that we reconsider the judgments we make. You know, how would you like to be judged because you're in between jobs? You know, I mean, I've been in between jobs at certain points. I'm very lucky that, you know, I've had a career where when I've gotten laid off, I've gotten reemployed relatively quickly. It's still really stressful. But during the Great Recession, the median time of unemployment was 40 weeks. And so that means that many people were unemployed for a year or more, and they didn't have a good answer to that question. And I think that as a country, we're going to have more periods of unemployment in between jobs. And we will hopefully use this as a time not to shame people, but to say, how can we really deal with not just the issues of work, which are critically important, but also our interpersonal relations? And I believe we have a lot of judgment right now.
You force us to confront again, though, that what we do when we have jobs is work really hard. And I just couldn't believe the number of unused vacation hours we accumulate across this country in a year. Was it like half a billion or something?
577 million days, not hours.
Days, okay.
Days,
wow.
Of unused. Yeah, and it's $200+ billion worth of unused vacation time. So basically, people are afraid to take vacation because they think, well, you know, if I take vacation, then that guy or that woman in the cubicle across the, you know, aisle is going to be the one who steps up and they're going to get the plaudits at work. And so we have this fear-based economy around even taking vacation. And so that makes for unhappy and unhealthy workers. And there's evidence that Americans are literally working themselves sick, that work, even white-collar work, can take years off your life if you don't take time to take breaks.
You talk about your own burnout at NPR, which apparently got pretty bad, but it also spurred you to mm-hmm. do some research. And so what did you find out about what stress does? Well, we've talked about cortisol many times on The Exchange, but you make a lot of it, apparently, when you work really hard.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's you know, working hard is great, but I was not working smart. So I was working, hosting the show News and Notes for NPR, and I originally was not the host. I was the correspondent, and I really loved doing field reporting. But then when they made a change in the host and I became the host, I was getting up at like 2 o'clock in the morning to be in the office by 4. And I wasn't getting enough sleep because I didn't like going to bed early and I didn't force myself to. Or when I did, I was taking sleeping pills, which have their own set of side effects. I mean, basically what I learned is I'm not meant to work at 4 in the morning, among other things. But I started, I've never been someone who, I'm a woman of size and I like my food, but I've always been someone who's more into like salty, fatty food like cheese. But I started eating all the sugar, you know, cupcakes and candy and whatever. And it was a biological reaction to the stress because your body uses sugars as this short-term fuel, particularly when you're sleep deprived. And it also relates to cortisol, as you mentioned, which is the stress hormone, which is perfectly good if you're running away from a lion, but not so good if you're pumping cortisol into your system every single day. And I learned that in addition to the biology of food and cortisol, there are also these things called telomeres, which are basically what keeps your DNA from degrading. And the telomeres also become stressed when you're stressed. So the basic message is that if you have stress in your life, whether it's work stress, family stress, other kinds of personal stress, you have to take extra good care of yourself. That means meditating or having other kinds of quiet time, exercise, really good nutrition. And yet your body is going to send you these weird messages that say, no, put down that kale bowl, go for the red velvet cupcake, you know? And it takes a bit of retraining yourself to go, because the body's evolutionary model is still not that different from when we were cavemen. You know, cavemen were like, I'm stressed, I'm going to eat some sugar, and I'm going to run fast. You know, we're different from that, but not so different biologically. So you have to, in some ways, think for your body. And when it comes to work, I was distressed to see all of the statistics on how much work can damage your overall health. So I think that as a matter of collective self-interest, we have to look out for ourselves and others. And employers are now beginning to spend more time on wellness in their offices when they can or when they choose. But I don't think it's reached the point that it has to yet to really ensure everyone's health.
Let's take a call. We have Vince and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Farai Shadeya, the author of The Episodic Career.
Hello. I had a question about how many careers people are having in their lives now and jobs, because I was a counselor for 30 years for college students with disabilities, and we used to say people would normally have one or two careers in their life and maybe 5 to 7 jobs, but I saw that changing quite a bit the last 5 years of my, career. And even though I was a counselor, I had to work really hard at building in wellness to my life because the number of students they wanted me to see kept going up higher and higher. Originally, I had an hour to see a student for counseling, and then it was a half an hour. Then they wanted me to see three students in an hour. I was doing all the things I thought were right. Yoga after work, swimming on the weekend, meditation, and still the stress was tremendous, and I eventually had to leave. I was a Peace Corps volunteer myself. I was in Colombia, so I knew Spanish. I learned some sign language. Mm-hmm. And now I'm looking for, you know, a second job in my 60s, and I can't even get an interview with the skills and background I have.
All right. Thanks for that, Vince. Appreciate that. So the base back to the basic numbers he was citing, though, the 1 to 2 jobs and or 1 to 2 careers and 7 jobs. How much of those numbers multiplied, Farai?
Yeah. Well, I have to say, first of all, that, you know, I definitely want to also talk about Vince's job search at his age. But starting out with the question of careers, it's pretty clear that millennials today will be switching jobs probably every 2 to 4 years. So if you think about an average career span lasting 40 to 50 years, that's a lot more than, you know, just 7 jobs, because that's been the number that has been floating around for a long time. Oh, you're going to have 7 different jobs over your lifetime. It's accelerating exponentially, particularly for people who are younger. And the number of careers people will have is also changing. You know, it's much more common for people to have, you know, 4 or 5 or sometimes even more actual careers, not just jobs, but careers within one life cycle. But what I would say to Vince is that there's definitely evidence that once you reach your 50s and above, it is harder to find work through traditional means of just applying for open jobs. But networking is really the way to go, and weak ties are the key to networking, meaning you're not just talking to people in your inner circle. You're talking to people who, you know, maybe it's that guy from college you haven't talked to in years, or the person who you met at a book event the other month. You have to reach out to people who you don't even know that well, or you haven't stayed in touch with on a regular basis, and tell them you're looking, because people who don't know you as well, actually, first of all, they see you differently. They don't necessarily put you in a box. People who love you, who are your friends, they may think of you the way that you think of yourself, which can be great, but it can also be a little bit limiting. And someone who doesn't know you as well or hasn't seen you in a while is like, I remember you were really good at this. Have you kept this up? And you're like, well, maybe, you know, I don't really do that much anymore, but I could go back to doing this thing. And you get inspiration and connections from people on the outer edges of your circle that are more likely to lead to jobs, even then from just the people on the inside of your circle. So I hope that Vince can take that approach and that it pays off for him.
That's an interesting concept, though, that the people a little further out from your inner circle are the ones who don't have necessarily fully formed opinions of you and or beliefs about what you can do. Farai Shadeya is our guest on The Exchange. Her book is The Episodic Career, and you can join the discussion at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Farai, you, as you put it, the right work suits you, is ethical, and compensates fairly. How rare is that kind of job these days?
Well, I think it's not rare, but I do think that it's something you have to work for. So in terms of compensation, you know, obviously all of us have a figure in our mind of what we're worth, and also an idea in our mind of what we're willing to get to do to get that. So right now I have 2 different jobs. I'm a professor at NYU and I'm a writer at 538. And it's a real juggle for me. You know, it's like I work on the weekends all the time. But I also have a lot of flexibility. I'm not complaining. You know, I have a lot of flexibility. I work long hours, but I get a lot for what I do in terms of the ability to travel and the ability to meet interesting people and the ability to talk to you right now, you know. But other people have different math. You know, if you have a family and you have certain obligations, you might not want as much flexibility, but what you might want is a steady commitment that I can go into work early in the morning and I can leave every day at 3 and pick up my kids. And so each of us has to understand what the bargain is that we're making and be good with that bargain, and our employer also has to be good with that. Some employers are more open than others. But just briefly on ethics, I mean, I interview people who've been whistleblowers as well as people who've been at companies embroiled in fiscal scandals. And I think a lot of times there's this assumption when we're going through a hard time in the country that you have to throw your ethics to the wind. And I would say, please don't. You know, whether ethics to you means how you treat the person across from you at work, or whether ethics means how you look at the spreadsheets, don't see this as a race to the bottom, because we're never going to get anywhere like that. And I really try to demonstrate that having a fearful mentality that goes against personal ethics and business ethics is not the way to survive in this economy.
Fearful mentality seems to be fairly prevalent, though. Anybody who heard, and we dealt with this a couple of days ago on the program, the NPR project to figure out what are making voters anxious this year, the economy is number one. I mean, people are always concerned about jobs.
Well, people are right, I mean, to be anxious. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say don't be anxious. What I'm saying is, instead of taking it out on other people, try to do collective problem solving, because you know, there's that whole joke that if there's a bear chasing you in the woods, you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun the other two hikers, you know?
Right.
And I think that mentality has kind of suffused American business today. But I think that if you team up with people and you try to find a strategy to say, how can we get away from trouble together, you're actually better off. But that requires a sense of trust, and not all workplaces have environments that foster a sense of trust. And sometimes, unfortunately, it's the management that pits people against each other. Like, I know that we all saw many of us saw the article on Amazon that came out a while back in the New York Times, and it was online, where employees at Amazon could submit anonymous complaints about each other. And it becomes a vicious cycle of teardowns where, you know, if you feel like you're threatened by someone, you can put in an anonymous complaint about them, and they may not have done anything wrong. Now, you know, I'm sure that there's some whole managerial justification for this, and I understand a way that anonymous tips can help under certain circumstances. But if it becomes a strategy for career advancement, for you to tear down other people, that's pretty horrible to me.
That does sound pretty awful. But, you know, the other things that you point out, too, that companies do, you point out a lot of companies have a fair amount of cash on hand to hire new workers, but don't. They tend to run, it seems like, very thinly staffed relative to their overall needs.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what we're seeing now is that a lot of the companies that are making the most money and have the highest profit margins are not putting that back into investing in new jobs. And so you have a lot of companies, particularly some of the technology companies, that are doing extremely well, but they do not step up and reinvest that in employment. And so it becomes very difficult to say what the right approach to the employer-employee contract is. The guy who started LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman, co-wrote a book that I cite in my book that talks about the need for employers to invest in job training, even when they know that a lot of their employees will move on. But it's this idea of creating a virtuous circle where, let's say that you know the world has only 10 companies and that people move around those 10 companies all the time. But if those 10 companies each train people, those companies will still have highly trained workers. But right now, a lot of the companies are saying, well, I don't know, my employees might go over to company B. I can't train them. So it's really been left up to workers to retrain themselves, and that's put a huge financial burden and time burden on people who already have a lot of responsibilities.
Which is something you point out that Austin Goolsbee, who was a White House economic advisor, has discovered is, in fact, the truth, that they don't want to put money into people who they think might leave in a couple of years for training.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Yes.
Yeah. And so what I always advise is that people need to go ahead on their own and spend that time investing in their own job education. You know, I have retrained myself many ways. I was you know, someone who taught myself HTML in 1995 so I could start a website. And that paid off in many, many, many ways in my career. I, on my own, took classes to learn audio editing and video editing. And I think it's never a bad idea to increase your skill set.
Right, because that might be the one thing that that the employer is looking for that you have in your toolbox that can come to work for you. We're talking about the episodic career with Farai Shadeya, subtitled How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. A lot of people report that disruption. We'll come back and talk more with Farai, and there are actually some exercises to go through in the book to figure out how to get your skills in order for the next job. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Farai Shadeya and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Farai Shadeya, formerly the host of NPR's News and Notes, now at New York University and at 538.com, among other things. She's one person who's had to learn how to put together several jobs to form a career. Her book is called The Episodic Career, How to Thrive at Work in the Age of Disruption. A lot to talk about here. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 over the phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. As we talk about things like we talked earlier, where there are so many unused vacation days in America, so many people working so hard, and at the same time, so many people looking for work, this is what always mystifies me. It certainly seems like it behooves the relative well-being of workers and the people who need work to maybe offer some more jobs out there. Why does that not seem to run across the minds of the people who are in positions to do that?
Well, okay, there could be many different ways I could answer this, but I'll start out with fiduciary duty. So corporate structures say that there is a fiduciary duty to the stockholders to maximize stockholder value. So if not hiring more people produces more dividends or more stock value, then that is actually the reason that the company exists. It operates on a principle that says your mission is to create stockholder value. Your mission is not to create jobs. Now, there has arisen a new type of corporation called the B Corp, which brings social value into the overall fiduciary duty. But some people make an argument, and it's not technically wrong, that if creating more jobs is bad for the bottom line, then you are actually breaking your contract with the stockholders. I think that the problem is, and we've seen this with Walmart recently laying off 16,000 people, is that if you don't have people with jobs that can buy things, then the American economy, which is a consumer-based economy, starts to collapse. You know, if everyone says, well, I just have a duty to create value for the shareholders, but you don't reinvest in American jobs, eventually you reach a point where people don't have the money to buy the things that make the company's profit. You know, so I would argue that our very concept of what companies are meant to do undermines this idea of the health of the American worker.
I wonder if too, when we talk about companies not willing to put training into employees because they think the employees will take those skills and walk off to go someplace else, so why bother to train them? If it becomes something of a self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, we think you'll leave, and so you do.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. No, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, you know, I teach undergraduate and graduate students, and they do not have a lot of loyalty to the idea of the corporation because they've been taught very clearly that corporations are not going to invest in them long term for the most part. Now, there's always exceptions, and I'm not going to say that every corporation is the same. There's many that do invest in people. But by and large, the millennial generation has been taught from the get-go that they have to fare for themselves. And some people look at millennials as spoiled and you know, having a poor work ethic. But what are they supposed to think? You know, if they know that companies are not invested in them, how are they supposed to operate in this world? So I really push back against this idea that millennials are just spoiled. I mean, some are. Some people who are older are spoiled. But when you know that you're not viewed as a long-term asset to a company, then you act one way. If you believe that you have a long-term future, you act a different way.
Let's take a call. We have Sandy in Mount Shasta on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. The book is The Episodic Career, the author Farai Shadeya.
Yeah, hi. Well, I'm totally in agreement with your proposition about how the work world is going. Back in the late 70s, I was at the end of one career and had no clue what to do with another one. So I stumbled across Richard Bowles' book, and it seems like you're kind of in the same tradition where you're taking a little further, and you're young enough to have a little more insight, perhaps, into how things are shifting right now. I was curious about, Richard Bowles had his skills.
We're talking about What Color is Your Parachute? That's Richard Nelson Bowles.
Yeah, What Color is Your Parachute? Sorry. And his book is based around a skills identification thing, where yours seems to be based around a work-life matrix. So I'm curious to know what the basis of the work-life matrix is.
Okay, thanks for that, Sandy. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Sandy. I appreciate you asking that. So my work-life matrix is, you're definitely right. So What Color is Your Parachute, which I think is an amazing book, and I urge people to read it in my book, is based on a lot of skills evaluation, but it also gets into motivation. And the work-life matrix here asks four essential questions. One is, how much of an appetite for risk do you have? Two is, do you consider yourself more interested in innovating or executing, meaning finishing projects? Three has to do with, do you want to work for a greater social good, or are you working primarily for money? And finally, there's this whole question of, how you look at the world regarding, hold on, I need to look it up. I want to make sure that I'm phrasing my own question the right way. I hate doing this because...
That's all right. Essentially, what you end up with is a series of switches here in four different categories. So you're cautious, you're a risk taker.
And I hate doing this, but like the final one is about decision making, like solo decision making or team decision making. But long story short, it's not about skills as much as it is about proclivity. So it's really a question of, what is it that you want from work outside of your specific skill set. So in this categorization, I'm something that's called the promoter, which is RHIT, which means that I'm a risk taker, I want to do high social impact, I'm an innovator, and I like doing like making team-based decisions. And so the promoter category is not about self-promotion, which obviously I do that too, because I write books, but it's about promoting an idea in the world. So one person who I talk to, who's the person I profile in the promoter category, is a woman who's 94 years old, and she's a full-time national parks ranger. And what she's promoting are these ideas about living history, the importance of the national parks, the importance of archiving, the work that is done. And so each archetype, you have these four questions and you have this 16-category archetype. Each archetype leads you to understand a little bit more about how people who think like you and feel like you operate in the world. But then on top of that, I do list categories that go along with each archetype. So there is a bit of job matching. So you find that entrepreneurs, for example, are much more likely to be risk takers. So, that's not a surprising thing. And it doesn't mean that if you're not a risk taker, you can't be an entrepreneur, but people who have that appetite for risk and are willing to put themselves out there and have a company fail. I talked to Justin Dangle, who is a serial entrepreneur, and his first company didn't do as well as he would like. But he says, at the end of the day, to be an entrepreneur, you have to view the world as a glass that's fundamentally half full, not half empty. And you have to recover from your failures and keep moving forward. And you have to believe that you can make the world a better place. And now he's running an insurance company with a market capitalization of $600 million. So clearly he recovered from, you know, his ups and downs. And so, so the work-life matrix really is just a chance for you to take a self-diagnostic assessment and look at different ways that you think. And what I think is also really interesting is that you can do it with other people in your workplace or other people in your family, and you can begin to understand a little bit more of their individual reasoning. So one of the things that I found that was really interesting is that people who are driven to mission-driven work are actually less happy than people who work for money.
Really?
So that sounds weird, right,
mm-hmm.
overall? But when you think about it, if you're someone who sets yourself a goal of making $75,000 a year, you know when you've reached that goal. You know, and the goal could change. Maybe it's $250,000 a year, but you it's like you set a goal, you hit it. When you set a goal of, I want to make the planet safer, I want to make education better, when you have goals like that, they kind of are never ending. And so I think that it's not that people who do mission-driven work are fundamentally unhappy people, but the bar is so high. And so even understanding that, it gave me a little bit more peace of mind because I'm really hard on myself. Like I'm a mission-driven worker, and I'm really hard on myself. Like, am I telling the right stories? Am I talking to the right people? And understanding the statistical background on people who think like me was actually kind of comforting.
You know, as I look at this, and I have not gone through the whole question process, but just looking at the binary choices you make here, I ended up coming up with a CPIS for myself, which is listed as the Masterful Realist. And as I turn to that section of the book, it says, frequent and fearless job changing. Ha ha, I think I need to answer more questions.
So have you been in the same field for a long time?
Oh, yeah. I've been my whole life has been in broadcast journalism.
That's great. Yeah, no, I mean, the thing is, it's like these archetypes are not meant. You can be in one archetype and have had a very different experience, but I would bet that within doing the same thing in the same field, you've had to adapt and that you've had to be flexible.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to have, you know, even if you're not a job changer, you may have an adaptable mindset that has allowed you to hold the same job.
Let's take another call. We have Jeannie in Medford. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to The Exchange with Farai Shadeya, the author of The Episodic Career.
Hi, I love that beautiful name. Oh,
thank
sorry.
You.
No, the cat just jumped down. The siren's coming. I can focus.
Right.
The storm just came up here, the wind and the rain.
Okay.
My mother always said, a rolling stone gathers no moss, because I had every job from A to Z, and I mean that, from truck driving to high fashion modeling, the lower end, you know, cleaning toilets and all the way up to administrative assistant for an aerodynamic corporation. And the thing is, I had a wonderful time. I learned so much. Every job I learned something, and I'm fully satisfied with that. Although I didn't work anywhere over 10 years to retire or get a pension, but I think that life experience was great for me. And the funny part is when I applied to American Airlines for a stewardess job,
mm-hmm.
they said, well, gee, you've worked in a lot of states, a lot of different jobs. I said, yeah, that's why I'd make a good stewardess. I like to travel. They said, not. You're unstable.
Ah, well, sorry about that, Jeannie, but thanks for the life story. But, you know, this is a great, great attitude, I guess, that we should think about copying for Raya.
Yeah.
And
I also think that what Jeannie says is also, you know, times are changing. So someone like Jeannie, who is adaptable and flexible and enjoys doing different things, at one point in time that was viewed as unstable or flighty. And companies look down on it, and now they're like, we need adaptable people. We need people who can roll with the punches. And so I think that there's also a cultural change in kind of how we, as a society, view people who move around. So I think if Jeannie had started her career a couple of decades later, she might have gotten that job, you know, as a flight attendant. So we also have to realize that as the cultural norms change, also employers' expectations change.
Is the work-life matrix your own creation? I ask because it bears some similarity to the Myers-Briggs personality types and that four-letter code.
Yeah, I was definitely inspired by the Myers-Briggs types, but I was mainly inspired by the fact of just doing lots of reporting. Like, I didn't do the work-life matrix until after I had been doing reporting on this for a few years, because this book was a very slow bake, and the stories in it come from years of reporting. And I started to see these patterns among different people, that some people were very, you know, had a very high appetite for risk, and others were very risk averse, you know, that some people really liked making the team decisions. And so each of the categories that I chose is based on observed behavior. When I look at how I, as a reporter, function, I start with observed behavior in people. I start by really looking at what people already are doing, and then the statistical research came out of the years of observation.
Well, it's certainly well put together. You can sense the slow and careful bake on it, because of the fact that there's stuff in here that certainly is enough to concern any worker, but not to scare people, too, and then ways to work out of whatever situation you think you might be in. Farai Shadeya wrote it. It's called The Episodic Career. Farai, thanks so much. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. And